You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
After decades of declining numbers, union membership in the United States fell to a 70-year low in 2010. Jane McAlevey looks into why this is the case and explains how she thinks the labor movement can be revived in her book, Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement. It's an account of her own experiences as a union organizer, from her victories bringing workers together to improve their working conditions and pay, to the turf wars and internal union politics she found herself caught up in. She was here in December to talk about the future of organized labor, and we got a lot of response from listeners, so we're re-airing it for you today. I start off by asking, should I assume that union membership has dipped even further since 2010?
It's sort of holding steady, and that steady is quite low. It's about 6.9% in the private sector right now.
You have called, and what is it in the public sector?
It's just under 12%. The combined level of unionization is just under 12% for public and private sector workers in America. It's an all-time low.
But it is my sense from what we've seen in a number of states that the public sector union membership may wind up declining as well.
The public sector membership actually is declining in places like Florida and Wisconsin, where you've seen vicious attacks led by sort of a united governmental force, people like Scott Walker in Wisconsin. And, you know, the governor in Governor Scott in two similar names in Florida, incidentally, comes out of being an executive with the Healthcare Corporation of America, HCA, which is one of the corporations that the workers in the book, you know, win a tremendous series of victories against. But yes, public sector union membership is on the decline, and I think it's because the same forces that sort of took their guns out on the private sector workers in this country and their unions have now turned their guns on the public sector.
But the public obviously doesn't seem to be totally concerned. After all, Scott Walker was saved when he was had to face a recall vote in Wisconsin.
He was spared in the recall vote, but if you look at Ohio, where similar measures were taken by Governor Kasich, the voters who went to the polls overwhelmingly turned back the ballot initiative by ballot initiative and restored collective bargaining rights and the rights of workers in Ohio. And I think that really in Wisconsin, it was a much more complicated story that many voters actually thought that the remedy wasn't right. That was all. So there, if you look at a much more fair living playing field in the state of Ohio, when community came together with organized labor, and that's a big theme in the book, right? When communities organically come together and understand that unions are nothing more than part of the community, and together they fight back in defense of decent wages, family-supporting wages, the right to have a say at work, the right to control their schedule, I think we'll find that when we do our work the way the folks in Ohio did, that communities actually do push back against these kind of laws.
You've called your book Raising Expectations. What do you mean by that? What expectations are we raising here?
I think, you know, I'm trying to speak as an organizer, which is what my life profession has been. And raising expectations is one of the most important things that an organizer can do in the labor movement. When I say raising expectations, what it means is this. American workers are told, and Americans are told often, but American workers are told all the time that there's something wrong with them. That's why things aren't working right now. That if they just worked harder, things would work out fine for them. And the truth is, it isn't about just working harder anymore in America. Systematically, we've offshored the best jobs in this country. And now we've got a situation where even if you're a very hard-working American, you go to one job and you make minimum wage, and that doesn't come anywhere close to supporting a family. So your wife or husband or your partner then takes up a full-time job. And even two workers working minimum wage full-time in America doesn't even get you to the poverty line. So what raising expectations means is it's the process by which organizers re-engage in conversations with workers about what's wrong, who's really to blame, and how they themselves, the workers themselves, need to take charge of sort of rebuilding a process that lets them regain family-supporting wages. And in this case, by forming a union, it's still the best anti-poverty strategy America has.
Hasn't worker efficiency improved
worker
over
efficiency
the years
has improved,
in this
yeah.
country?
Yes.
There was an article in the Times the other day that showed in the graph worker efficiency went up pretty high and wages remained relatively on a straight line.
Wages have been on a straight line since 1973 in America. And what's important, I think, about this discussion, and it goes back to the raising expectations issue, What's important is that there really has been a pronounced attack on American unions in this country, and it began in the 1970s. It began with something called the Business Roundtable. And there's really no accident to the mess that we're in this country right now. The question is, how are we getting out of it? Part of what the book talks about is how do we get out of it, right? But the mess that we're in America first begins an attack on the private sector workers and their unions, right? So instead of having a decent job with decent wages, all those kind of jobs, steel workers, the paper mill left. And who came in to replace the paper mill and the steel mill? Walmart, for example, right? But the difference is that someone was making $20 an hour in the paper mill, and now they're making $6 an hour at Walmart. So the math doesn't add up. There's something really fundamentally wrong. So American wages have actually been held steady at the same level since 1973, despite productivity. And the only way American workers have been surviving, again, is because we've got two parents working full-time jobs. And by the way, that's not working real well for American workers. There's a corollary to why kids aren't doing that well in school anymore, because their parents aren't home to be able to give them a basic, you know, homework lesson.
Now, you said that it all started in the 70s. Most Americans would say it started when Ronald Reagan fired striking air traffic control workers in 1981. Was that a turning point?
It was a turning point. I think you're right, Leonard. It was a turning point, but I think that the effort began before then. I think that Ronald Reagan firing the air traffic controllers crystallized a sort of major, it was like a blunt weapon in the legal arena against unions in this country. What Ronald Reagan did in 1981 was make it legal to permanently replace striking workers by allowing corporations or government entities who were their employers to replace a striking worker. It essentially began to take away the power that Americans' unions had to even take a strike in this country.
But could he have done it if the public wouldn't go along with it? Despite all the negative publicity Walmart gets about its labor practices, people continue to shop there in great numbers.
It's true. And part of what we have to do, and the book talks about this, part of what we have to do is we do have to restore a sense of sort of morality and decency through consumerism. There was a time in this country when consumers understood, we had an educated consumer force that understood that they were going to shop union. Now I'm going back to the way back to the 1930s and 40s in America. But part of what the book argues is that we do need to look back into the 1930s and 1940s in terms of some of the practices that American consumers and American unions were exhibiting. And in the case of, you know, in the case of American consumers, part of what I argue in the book is that American unions today need to take what's called a whole worker approach. They need to view the worker themselves as not simply a worker, but as a whole person in their community. And it's when American unions begin to take up broader issues of concern in the community that I think you can then have a conversation that says, by the way, Sally, George, Mo, whoever your name is, does it make sense for you to be shopping at Walmart? When what Walmart's done fundamentally is restructured the entire system of wages in America in a very, very bad way, getting tax subsidies, getting tax breaks. I don't know if you saw this yesterday, but the Walton family, just the family that owns Walmart, now their net worth is equal to 40% of American families combined. There's something really wrong with that. And that's the story of what's been going wrong since 1973.
You refer to whole worker organizing. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think the way that we get back to an educated consumer class that will then support sort of a laborized workforce when they go shopping is when the American union understands that when 7% of the workers are in the private sector or in a union, that what American labor has to do is take up the broad cause of the American laboring class. That means childcare. That means climate change. That means all sorts of things that may be going wrong in your neighborhood. That means fixing up broken houses. That means fighting for affordable rents in New York City. It means a broad class of issues that really affect the American worker right now.
So unions haven't been building alliances in the way that they should?
I mean, I would argue no, honestly. And there's been some good effort at it. And, you know, I think there's a lot of terrific intentions right now in the union movement. But the theory that we lay out in the book is a theory that says very simply this. When a worker comes to work and they have a bunch of concerns at work and the union begins a conversation with them, when that worker goes home, they generally have a temple, a synagogue, a church. They go to a mosque. They go somewhere. They carry relationship into their community. They then take their kid to the PTA and to the Little League. And they've got a whole series of relationships at the Little League. And they've got people they talk to at the soccer field. And it's when unions with great intentionality build relationships back into American workers' communities by actually going into the community meetings with the worker that we're going to have the most most organic alliances built between workers and their communities that will rebound in every way to support American labor unions.
Now, when we talk about unions, we are not talking about some monolithic group. We're talking about unions that are very socially committed. We're talking about unions that have been accused of being sexist and racist.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's no excuse for that. So let me just be clear. You know, there's absolutely no excuse for bad behavior. But we've got bad behavior in every institution in America, large and small, whether it's churches, schools, governmental agencies, corporations, certainly. And what we don't say at the end of that is, well, let's ban corporations because we found a bad one, or let's ban churches because we found a bad one, right? In fact, we say quite the opposite. So I think I'm the first to say, this book is the first to say and acknowledge that there are real mistakes being made in the American labor movement, and I agree. But we've got bigger problems that we have to take on.
My guest is Jane McAlevey, McAlevey. Her book, Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement. You begin the book actually talking about the presidential election of 2000, the recount in Florida. Why do you begin there?
You know, I begin the book because I was working on the front lines of the Florida recount. And in my experience, part of what we need to do as a labor movement is separate ourselves from either political party, whether it's the Democratic Party in particular or the Republicans, when it comes to the governing period, which we're in right now, by the way. We're about to enter a new governing period for 4 years. I begin in Florida because to me it's sort of a metaphor for one of the challenges facing the American labor movement, which is that they don't have enough independence from the Democratic Party right now. So it's fine for us to support a Democrat when it's election time, in that case Al Gore, but what's not okay is that we don't then sort of separate and realize that there are different interests, different skills, different abilities. American democracy doesn't work because people show up and vote. It works when people get involved in local town boards, school boards, and everything else they're doing. And that's the same for America's unions. You have to be involved in them.
Well, you suggest here that there was resistance to using the unions for grassroots activity. The grassroots activity is being credited with helping President Obama get reelected. The Republicans didn't do enough of it. They ran a lot of ads instead. So what was the problem then?
You know, I think in Florida it was a very, there was a very sort of beautiful, almost innocent, I think, belief on the part of Al Gore that the legal process would work. And so part of the metaphor, again, coming out of the beginning of the book, is that American workers can't sit home and Americans can't sit home when something's going wrong. We actually have to stand up and fight. That's really part of what the lesson in the book is. So what I'm trying to say is, from 2008 until 2012, not a lot was happening. There was a lot of behind-the-scenes conversations about ways to make improvements in this country, but there was an unwillingness on the part of unions to stand up and take on the White House from 2008 to 2012. And partly, there's a lot of issues where there should be a fight happening in this country right now, and one is the housing crisis and the mortgage crisis. You know, we've got an economic crisis that is absolutely devastating American families. And a major part of that is the housing crisis. Well, you know, the New York Times almost every week, it feels like, does an editorial on the op-ed pages about how it's time to fix the housing crisis. And you know what? For 4 years, there was no one in the American labor movement leading the cause to fix the housing crisis, when that's a major issue of concern to American workers.
One of the proposals on the table for not going over this so-called fiscal cliff is reducing mortgage deductions for taxpayers. Won't that just exacerbate the situation?
Yeah, that's I don't know whose proposal that is, but it wouldn't be one that I think we have to be really clear about several things. One is that there has not been enough fairness on the part of people making a ton of money in this country paying their fair share. They just haven't. And the second thing is, I think we have to get away from the whole fiscal cliff discussion. I mean, the truth is, there has been one big fiscal cliff in America, and it's been happening for several years to the working class. They were pushed off of a cliff, and the discussion has to return to, how can we restore the basic freedom of association and the basic freedom of speech inside of America's workplaces so that American unions themselves could begin to actually rebuild vibrant, robust unions? The fact is this. The book tells a story about thousands of workers in Nevada. And the story in Nevada began like many places in America right now, where you had a non-unionized private sector hospital system. And over the course of just 3 years, thousands of workers in Nevada came together to form unions. And in just 3 years, they went from paying $400 a month for dependent coverage for health care to paying nothing. They went from having very, very poor wages as health care workers in America to seeing on average 10 and 12% raises a year to catch up. The point is, globalization isn't really the problem. What we need to do in this country is restore American workers' rights to have a say about what's going on at their workplace and have some freedom of association. And then we could actually begin to try and rebalance a very gross inequality in the American economy.
Does the economic crisis give unions a boost does it make organizing more difficult because people are told that union jobs are driving the jobs to other countries and that's the reason for high unemployment in states like Nevada?
Yeah, except that's just not true if you look at all the numbers. I think the economy right now is very difficult. On this NPR station, on this radio station this morning, there was a report from the Annie Casey Foundation, which said, not surprisingly, that teenage unemployment is really high. And the reason that teenage unemployment is really high is because you've got grown-ups working in fast food jobs in New York City, and which is why we saw a bunch of actions by fast food workers last week, right? There's a myth that it's teenagers. And the Annie Casey report this morning is only the latest report to give absolute facts to the fact that we've got a problem with our economy. The problem right now is that there aren't enough good jobs. And the only way we're going to make good jobs is when American workers have the right to form unions again. Back in the 1920s and 30s and 40s in America, working at an auto plant wasn't exactly a great job. It became a decent job in this country because American workers fought tooth and nail to have the right to form unions. That began to shift the balance away from rapacious, gross profit levels and greed, back to having some decency for the American worker.
Although the unions are blamed for the problems that Detroit has faced in recent years. But we'll get to that in a little while and some other issues. My guest is Jane McAlevey. Her book, Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement, it's published by Verso. Stay with us. We're back with a conversation I had in December with Jane McAlevey, McAlevey. She was here to discuss her book, Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement. It was a great conversation, and we are re-airing it for you today. I began the second part of our conversation by noting that she used 1995 as a starting point for her book. It was the year that John Sweeney was elected as president of the AFL-CIO, and I asked Jane McAlevey, why was that election an earthquake, as you call it?
Well, it was the first contested election in the American Labor Federation. The AFL-CIO is the American Federation of Labor, Congress of Industrial Organizations. And it was an earthquake because it was a shift from what we might think of as the old economy controlling the Labor Federation to the new economy. So John Sweeney had been the president of the Service Employees International Union, and him coming into the highest level of leadership of the American labor movement really was the first acknowledgement that our economy had changed. And as such, the head of the Service Workers Union, who had represented a lot of low-wage workers, became the chief of the American Federation of Labor. And that
earlier it had been manufacturing.
Always the manufacturing sector. That's exactly right. Steelworkers, coal workers, et cetera. And, by the way, right now Rich Shumka comes out of the Coal Miners Union. He's head of the AFL-CIO. So I think people realized it wasn't necessarily about who led the Labor Federation. I think it was about acknowledging that the economy in this country has taken a profound change, as big a change as it did when it went from the agrarian economy to the industrial economy. We've now made a change that's profound from the industrial economy into a service economy. And the question is, how do we begin to rationalize a fair wage and benefit system in a new economy?
But John Sweeney came in promising to reverse the tide. Unions were losing power at the point. He did nothing of the sort. Why?
Well, if you get into what some of the behavior of some of the very best unions in this country, there has been real reversals. And the example I tell in Nevada is one alone. I mean, we took thousands and thousands of workers and took them from really very poor working conditions. They were both low wage and what we might call middle income wage, registered nurses, decent wage earners. In their case, by the way, they had lost control of their schedules. What every woman worker would like to have is some control of their schedule, some predictability, some time with their children, some time at the bus stop when their kid comes home. So I think that there are a lot of pockets of great success in the last decade that you can look at. And the Nevada story that we tell in the book is one of those places.
Nevada is a right-to-work state.
It is a right-to-work state, which to me only underscores that when we have good union leadership, it is still the single best way that American workers can climb up and out of poverty and to gain some control of their life and their schedule and have any ability to get home and spend time with their kids.
But Nevada also is really suffering right now. You're saying that's totally separate from anything that has to do with unions?
Oh, yeah, except that we need more unions, absolutely. I mean, Nevada is a typical low-wage service economy. You know, it rises and falls because it's a vacation economy, so it really rises and falls based on how many folks are flying in and out. Then we get into a very big discussion about property taxes, tax systems, et cetera.
But a major reason for the decline in union membership is the decline in manufacturing in this country. Jobs have been shipped overseas, and it's been pointed out that the U.S. manufacturing can't really compete with cheap non-union labor overseas.
It's absolutely right.
And people have said that the unions have kind of put themselves, their workers out of jobs.
Yeah, I think that that's really backward logic. Here's what really happened. We created a form of globalization led out of America that basically said, we're going to take auto workers and private sector industrial workers in America, and we're going to put them in direct competition with workers in Burma and China and Mexico and El Salvador and Guatemala, where workers have no rights at all. They get paid a dollar a day. And then we're going to say, hey, the American worker looks kind of overpaid. The fact is that was by deliberate design. In Germany, if you take a look at the German system right now, you know, in Germany, you don't see the kind of downward degradation of the status of the worker the way you do in America. And that's in part because in Germany, unions share half of the seats on the board of directors of every major corporation in Germany. And so they didn't create a system of globalization that said, let's ship all the jobs overseas. So, you know, the truth is, again, in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, a steel worker, an auto worker, someone who worked in a coal mine did not have, quote unquote, a good job in this country. It took the effort of people actually, in some cases, dying in the streets to unionize American workers to bring them up to a decent standard of living. We've got a new economy right now. It's a service economy. And the fast food worker strike and the strikes by the Walmart workers that we saw on, quote unquote, Black Friday, those are the kind of workers who need to be supported by Americans writ large.
What is your take on the hostess situation?
You know, I don't want to speak in great detail because I don't know the detail. What I do know is that what I've read about it is that, you know, the CEO of that company should be in jail. I mean, that's the simple problem is we've got corporations running amok right now and destroying tens of thousands of jobs on the part of, you know, good, hardworking Americans, and nothing actually is happening to them. And again, I want to go back to Walmart for just a minute. The idea that the Walmart CEO made $18 million last year and that the Walton family, that's the Walmart family, that their net wealth is now represents 40% of the combined income of 40% of America's workers suggests that something's really out of whack in our economy, that the rules are stacked in favor of CEOs and executives and against American workers.
On the other hand, when we talk about the auto industry, entitlements or the equivalent of entitlements, health care and pensions, et cetera, are now being blamed for many of the problems that the big three faced. Although it has also been argued that the big three all of the auto manufacturers at the time preferred not to see a national health care service come in. So they saw this as an alternative, then got locked into it.
I mean, part of what was right about the last sort of in the President Sweeney years, in the last 15 years, part of what was right about some of the smarter folks in the American labor movement was that they said, healthcare needs to be taken out of the equation. It needs to be delinked from being linked to your job. And pensions need to be delinked from your job. The problem is when you talk about taking pensions and the cost of healthcare and making it not an employer cost, you're talking about sort of some kind of a form of a much broader social insurance in America. And right now we have people talking about messing with Social Security and messing with Medicaid and Medicare. So what didn't work really for the American auto worker had nothing to do with their pensions and nothing to do with their wages. What didn't work was putting the American auto worker up against a dollar-a-day worker in a country where workers have no rights and no democracy and saying, suddenly you look overpaid, which, by the way, is similar to what's been taking place in that sort of full-throttled assault on government workers right now. So we've deunionized the private sector in America. 7% are in a union. Now, suddenly, you've got the same manufactured hysteria by people like Grover Norquist Norquist and the Chamber of Commerce, who are now trying to rile up Americans who don't have a pension and don't have health care to point the guns at government workers and say, why do you have something I don't have? When the job of an organizer about re-raising expectations for American workers is for us to turn to workers and say, no, the real question is, why don't you have a pension or health care? Why is the American dream being eclipsed? Why don't you have the right to have your kid go off to a good school and have one parent home doing homework with you? And it certainly isn't because middle-class Americans were making too much money in this country. It's by deliberate design of an economic system that has offshored our best jobs, and then we have a lack of freedom for American workers who are trying to form unions. And this book is filled with stories of heroic workers taking, you know, losing their jobs in the fight to form a union.
Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement, is Jane McAlevey's book from Verso. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Do you think that there's been a change in our culture with workers focusing on independence and autonomy, often changing jobs rather than staying with one company for their whole careers? A listener from Staten Island, Danielle, writes, she wonders if you think there is a future for organizing professional white-collar jobs, as most people have no concept of union jobs, and people who work in offices, she says, need to be united.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with your caller or the writer. I mean, look, again, the last 4.5 years of my full-time work in the labor movement, I was organizing workers that one would sort of think of at a sort of higher wage. Let's just take the case of registered nurses. And here's what. Registered nurses in this country whose salary is, you know, certainly way above a fast food worker or a Walmart worker, the truth is they have no control over their life, and they didn't until they formed a union when I was working with them. Their schedule was out of control. Their employer would change it every few days. There was no predictability. They couldn't set up a child care schedule. They didn't have child care. They had to go to work sick because they didn't have sick time paid by their employer, even though they were sick people every day. So I think there is hope. I think when most Americans in this country wake up and realize that they have very little rights on the job and that their quality of life is plummeting downhill, the best solution that every kind of worker in this country can have is to come together collectively and say it's time to form a union.
Well, there are other problems the unions themselves have caused. For example, for many years, mobsters controlled a lot of the unions, and a lot of people didn't want to join unions because they didn't want to be associated with them. And then union critics are often point to the grievance process and complain that unions make it impossible to fire incompetent workers and that unions protect those who don't perform. Also, seniority sometimes keeps incompetent people in jobs when some young hotshot might be doing a much better job.
Yeah, the only reason that a worker can't be fired is if middle management is incompetent in how they administer the contract. That's the simple truth. So having worked with the grievance process, again, there's a whole section in the book when I basically agree and say that the grievance process as we currently know it is kind of not really working, but that's a mini nuance in what's really wrong in this country. But I am the first to say in the book the traditional grievance process was very important with industrial sector workers and workers who faced a lot of, and any worker today who faces a lot of real danger on the job. When people raise that, they're generally talking about teachers or they're talking about government workers or something like that. And what I say, though, is really, it's just not true. For example, if the union is made up of the best workers in the workplace, which is what a good union is, just like a good democracy is made up of its best citizens. If a union is made up of the good workers in the workplace, 90% of workers in this country, 90% go to work and never engage something called the grievance process in their entire life. If 90% of the interest of workers who go to work and do a good day's job, if that's who we're talking about as leading the union, you don't have this bizarre process where someone is not getting fired. I mean, it's part of a made-up manufactured story about what's wrong with unions. And I can tell you that in the kind of unions that we formed, no good worker wants to defend a worker who's a slacker on the job. So that's just sort of it's true, but it's not the dominant story in America.
Well, Jane, a lot of people get involved with unions because they are idealistic, and then they have to deal with the unions themselves. You, in this book, talk about problems with union leadership. You even had to resign from your position as executive director of the SEIU following a struggle with another union leader after you'd had success in Nevada. There are all these other problems that unions are creating for themselves.
Yeah, I just think they're not the biggest problem that the American workers face right now. And look, the truth is, you know, I wrote this book in part to talk about, I'm a Giants fan, and it doesn't mean that, if Coughlin and Eli Manning are making a bad decision, I don't throw the sneaker at the TV, right? I mean, I'm trying to wake up some of the progressive union leaders and say that there's a better way to do the unions than we're doing it. But the fact of the matter is, American unions are all American workers have left. It's what's standing between total poverty, poverty wages, and no benefits in this country, and having a restored quality of life. It's the only thing that we have standing in our favor right now is rebuilding a robust union movement. That's better than.
Do you think that's likely? It sounds rather quixotic under current circumstances.
No, I don't think so. I think that the actions that you're seeing right now with the Walmart workers, with the strikes that took place, with the fast food strikes, with the hot and crusty workers forming a union just right here in New York, and the story in Nevada. I mean, this book tells a story of going into what's called very contentious turf where the rights for workers are far worse than the kind of rights that a New Yorker would have on the job. And with just a little bit of good direction, the workers came together by the thousands and formed a tremendous union. And by the way, chose to upend that traditional grievance process.
Isn't it illegal to fire people who are trying to organize a union? But we hear about them being fired all the time.
Yeah, this is really the reason that this book becomes so important, because we talk about workers being fired and regaining their jobs. But, you know, there is no freedom of association really in America's workplaces, and there's no freedom of speech. So in the campaigns that I describe in the book, we would have a 20-year registered nurse, nothing but the highest accolades ever, terrific write-ups by her employer, and the minute she put on a union button and became seen as a leader to form a union in her place of work because she wanted better quality outcomes for her patients, she was fired. And in her case, Joan Wells, I tell Joan's story. In Joan's case, it took us 3 years and probably $80,000 in legal fees to have Joan restored, because the firing, of course, was illegal. So that's part of the rebalancing that we have to do. If the free marketers in America want to really talk about a free market, we have to have the freedom of association and the freedom of speech restored to American workers.
But where is the NLRB in all of this?
They're a totally denuded, weak, beaten down agency, like most agencies in the last 20 years in this country. They've been defunded, underfunded. The system is not designed to work right now for American workers. So I dealt with the National Labor Relations Board frequently, all the time. So Joan, in the case of Joan's case, it took the NLRB a year and a half to rule that she had been legally fired, and another year and a half of them. And they did a great job in her case, litigating against the employer, Universal Health Services, one of the most powerful CEOs in America. Alan Miller sits atop a UHS. And there's Alan Miller unleashing millions of dollars of, you know, a legal attack against one lone nurse standing up for herself and forming a union. In her case, we restored her right. And she's still practicing nursing, and she's a terrific intensive care unit nurse. And it took her bravery, and it's going to take a lot of bravery for a lot of workers to kind of reclaim a new economy in America. And it took a lot of blood, sweat, and tears in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And part of what I hope that listeners understand is that it's going to take everyone. It isn't what's happening to those fast food workers down there somewhere in the middle of Manhattan. When people in New York City, when my friends and colleagues hear that workers are going on a picket line at a fast food company, you know, New Yorkers need to get up and go find those workers and go support them, whether it's through their church, their PTA, their Little League, because workers need a lift up in this country.
Jane McAlevey, her book, Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement, it is published by Verso. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.